The hungry baby is crying for food. The hairy parent is short on time. The solution? Give baby a baby food pouch. But that solution leads us to ask, do convenience foods do a baby's body good?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1376th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show and podcast. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Acordalia who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What? Folks, a modern times dilemma. Babies are the hope for a future, but an expense for the present. A big expense of a baby is, in the present at least, is the time the baby requires from the parent. In their first year of life, babies triple the size of their bodies. They need muscles to crawl and grab things. To build those muscles, babies need foods rich in healthy fats and protein. One of the most important responsibilities of a parent, therefore, is to feed the baby good food all day long. Wow, that is a job for very busy parents, especially time-poor parents, like most city folks are. Two jobs, two parents working, three or four jobs, nobody has any time, right? So feeding a baby good food all day long is a significant expense in time. But fear not, because industry has come up to the rescue of time-poor parents with disposable baby food pouches. Sales of these baby food pouches to time-poor parents has increased 900% in the last 13 years alone. But what is in those baby food pouches leads us to ask, do convenience baby foods do a baby's body good? Well, who better to ask than nutritionist, researcher, and mother, Dr. Elizabeth Dunford, who's a research fellow with the George Institute, and an assistant professor of nutrition at the University of North Carolina. Dr. Elizabeth Dunford, welcome aboard.
Thank you so much, Michael. Pleasure to be here.
And it's good to have you. We're down in North Carolina, and we're on the other side of the country, which so we got the whole country captured. You're a researcher, yeah. But you're also a research fellow with George Institute in Australia, as well as an adjunct professor of nutrition at the University of North Carolina, and a mother of two. So before we go anywhere, what can you, Dr. Elizabeth, tell us about being a time-poor parent?
I'm sure I can identify with all time poor parents out there. I'm obviously a working mother of two. I have two young children who are now 4 and 6 years old. And I will say I was definitely one of those parents, one of those time poor parents who turned to products such as those squeeze pouches and those other convenient commercially produced foods during their childhood when I needed something extra. And I really decided to do this study because as a mother, I thought, well, as a mother and a nutritionist, I should say, I thought, well, I know these products probably aren't as good as I hope they are. So let's have a look and see what's in them. And of course, then this study was born and the results were sadly not that surprising to me.
So what precipitated the story was a mother feeding her children, her babies, right?
That's right. I was feeding my children these types of products, and I have a lot of friends who are also time-poor parents. And again, being an expert in this sort of area, my research area is looking at how healthy all the foods in the grocery store are. And I developed this particular interest in baby foods simply because I was a mother and I was buying these foods. And as a nutritionist, I understood the importance of making sure my children consumed healthy foods. But like you say, when you're time poor, you turn to convenience, and the food industry is right there with a solution for us. And I thought it was really worth delving into what is in these foods and help try to educate people on how they can make a better choice in this time-poor, convenient
sector. When your article was published, it generated a lot of public press. My goodness! So, what is the title of your subject so people get a good idea of what it was?
So the paper that we published was titled "An Evaluation of the Nutritional and Promotional Profile of Commercial Foods to Infants and Toddlers in the United States." And what that means is we looked at a bunch of baby foods that were available in grocery stores here in the U.S. We looked at the top 10 retailers in the U.S. We collected those foods and we compared them to the World Health Organization standards for nutritional content and also promotional profile. And what that means is, are they adhering to the guidelines set by the World Health Organization in relation to what claims they are putting on the front of these packages of baby foods?
As a researcher, how do you go about targeting such a big selection of food?
That's a good question. I've been asked quite a lot recently with the media circus that was surrounding this paper. I've been asked, so what prompted this or how did I do it? And again, what prompted it is just my interest. So I took myself out to the grocery store and I collected these data myself from here in Raleigh, North Carolina, and some online sources, and pulled all this together and just had a look at the data and thought, well, let's put it out there to the public and show how terribly the baby food sector is doing here in the U.S.
So it's not that you took these baby foods off the shelves and submitted them to some kind of chemical analysis to see what was in the foods. You just read the directions.
No, not at all.
Read the ingredients, right?
That's right. So the George Institute for Global Health has a wonderful system called the Food Switch System to capture photos of products. So I went to each of these stores and I collected photos of all parts of the packages of all these products, and we entered the data, we looked at the data, we analyzed the data, and we had our results. Now, to do chemical analysis on these products would have been extremely expensive and time-consuming, and even most of these companies themselves don't use chemical analysis to determine their levels of sugar or salt or fat. For example, they calculate it based on what we know is in the ingredients that they use.
We've done radio.
We're quite confident in the quality of the data.
Yeah, we've done shows with mothers across America who look at school lunches, and they have people send them actual school lunches frozen, and then they submit them to chemical analysis. And what they found through the years is pretty much exactly what you found in your study as well. So let's have a look at what exactly is in baby foods. Yeah, you looked at 651 infant and toddler foods sold at 10 U.S. grocery stores. And what is in those foods?
So it's a good question. It really depends what we're focusing on here. The study, what we did is we compared the nutritional content of all of those products to the recommendations under the World Health Organization model. And that model has different requirements or recommendations depending on the type of product you're looking at. For example, if it's a product that is supposed to be more of a protein-based product, so something that is meat-based, for example, a meat puree or a puree that claims to sort of be protein-based, whether it's plant-based or animal source, that would be classified differently under the model, and we would be looking at protein as an important nutritional component versus, say, a fruit-based squeeze pouch, which would not necessarily have a protein requirement, but would have a sugar-based requirement or a fruit content requirement. And so what we found overall when we looked at all these products is only around 60% of these products, 60% of these products failed to meet the nutritional requirements, and that would mean all the nutritional requirements that the particular category required. And within that, there were different things. There were some products that failed terribly on protein content, for example, and then other types of products which did very well with protein content. There were some that did terribly with sugar and some that did better. And it really just depended on the particular type of product you were looking at. But I think the overall takeaway in my mind is that the majority of the products that are out there available for U.S. parents for their babies are not doing great.
So 3/5 of the baby foods on the shelves don't live up to the, what they need to live up to, in other words. Is that a fair assessment?
In other words, yes. Yeah, and the World Health Organization Nutrient and Promotion Profile Model, it is really the only model out there, and the World Health Organization is often looked to as a guide for countries all around the world. And this model was designed more for a European market, so it is important to note that each market is slightly different, but it's not so different that you would expect 60% of the products here to fail those nutritional requirements. And, of course, 100% failed the promotional requirements, which is probably the bigger finding here. And it does link to the nutritional points here, because if you think of it, every product had at least one prohibited claim, so a claim that the World Health Organization says should not necessarily be on baby food packages. Every single product had at least one claim, some up to 11 prohibited claims on a single package. And a lot of those times, products like squeeze pouches and snack size packages, they would have the most claims on pack, and they, of course, are more likely to be the less healthy products. And we call this the health halo effect that these food companies are trying to put out there. They are telling you, oh, this is no added sugar and it's no added salt. But in fact, it might be extremely high in sugar. It's just, it's not added sugar. It's just pureed fruit all the way down into a pouch, and a child is sucking that pouch down in about 2 minutes or less, probably. And so this ability for these companies to put all these claims on pack can make parents think that they're buying a healthy product when in fact they're not.
A pouch? A baby food pouch? What is a pouch? So I've been out of the baby business for a while. So there used to be baby bottles, right? And formulas.
So the squeeze pouches are what are really dominating the baby food market at the moment. These are these convenient pouches where you screw up the lid and the baby can just suck down the puree that's inside it. Think of it like an applesauce pack, which I still see teenagers consuming here in the U.S. It's crazy to me. But these squeeze pouches really allow children to consume quite high amounts of sugar in a very short space of time.
Which, of course, is not really what we want, because, you know, to build healthy bones and muscles, you need protein and you need fat, not sugar.
And also, you also need to learn how to eat properly. So a lot of the discussion around these squeeze pouches is that kids are sucking down. Even protein-containing products can be put into these squeeze pouches, but it's meaning that the children are not picking up the foods anymore. They're not holding the foods. They're not holding a spoon. They're not, using the pouch is supposed to be squeezed into a bowl, and then you are to eat it. But instead, people are eating.
Well, not only
that,
Dr. Elizabeth, but you're supposed to get it all over yourself, right? On your hands and on your face and all over the tray, and you have to make a mess of everything, and then you.
Michael, I will tell you, you can do that with the pouches too. my children definitely managed to do that. I've had quite a few pouch explosions. Yes, indeed, it's supposed to be the whole experience of eating. It's really, in some cases, being taken away if these squeeze pouches are used as a dominant part of the diet.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, I'd like to address this issue of 100% failed to meet promotional values. Promotional requirements of the WHO, 100% fail to meet. Now, that sounds like a disaster to me. So I want to pick that up and follow it as we go through the baby food issues here. This is the Food Chain Radio program. We're talking about babies' food, the food we feed babies, with Dr. Elizabeth Dunford, who is a researcher, a scientist, and a mother of two. So do stay tuned. We will be right back.
And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, What's Eating What today on the Food Chain radio program are the foods we are feeding babies these days. These days we live in cities. And we have two or three jobs in the family, and for two or three workers, so we're running short on time. And we're desperate for time when it gets right down to it. And so when baby needs to be fed, which is all day long, would that be a fair assessment, Dr. Lizzie?
Oh, yes, they're called snack monsters, little children, I think. Oh, that's what I call my children, yes.
feed me, like little birds. Feed me, feed me, feed me. So what do we do? We do not have time to stop what we're doing and feed them, cook a meal for them. So many of us are feeding them via snack pouches or food pouches, which are, I don't know, kind of like... I'm afraid to describe it. I'll probably get in trouble. So it's a plastic bag. You open the lid and you hold the lid up and you suck the food out. Is that the way that works?
That's a fair description. Yeah.
Okay. And 100% of these babies' food pouches fail to meet the promotional requirements of the WHO guidelines. Now, what exactly do you mean by promotional requirements, Dr. Elizabeth?
So it's a good question. There are quite a number of promotional requirements under this model. But the one that most products failed, or all products failed, was what we call the ingredient list clarity requirement. And so personally, I found this interesting because I'm an Australian by birth and spent majority of my life in Australia and now moved to the US. I understand the differences in how foods and food products here are labeled and how the ingredient list is handled. And so this ingredient list clarity requirement, it's no surprise that 100% failed here in the US, because the US does not have requirements to put the proportion of an ingredient on the ingredients list. And what I mean by that is if you have a product that you say is a vegetable puree, and you say it's sweet potato puree, for example, you would have to, in Australia and the UK and a lot of European countries, you would have to put the proportion or the percentage of that product that is sweet potato on the label. But in the US, you don't. And so it's unknown, for example, is that product mainly sweet potato, or is it just a little bit of sweet potato? Is it a little bit of sweet potato with apple? You know, we just don't have this clarity with the ingredients list here. So no products in the US had that information on the package, so they all failed that particular requirement of the WHO promotional criteria. But also followed closely behind with the fact that zero products also met the promotion of and protection of breastfeeding criteria. So the guidelines from the World Health Organization are that these products that are marketed to children who are still in the age group that should be being breastfed or formula fed, they should also carry a disclaimer that these foods should be supplementary to and complementary to breastfeeding or formula feeding, not to replace this. And so no products had that on pack. And also almost 100% had at least one prohibited claim, as I mentioned before, and some up to 11 prohibited claims on a single package.
Okay, before we go to the prohibited claims, I'd like to go back to the ingredients list. Now, though we do not here in the U.S. require percentages, we do require, I think, most of to the least of ingredients. So
that's true.
Yeah, you could. You can't really see what the percentage is, but you can see what the most used ingredient is. So there is some guidance there for working mothers.
Yeah.
Now, we use food pouches when we were raising our kid. What we did is we had a blender. We threw what we ate into the blender, and that's what the kid ate. In large terms. We didn't have any time. There were two working adults, you know, so we were really short on time, but through that adroit use of a blender, we were able to eat good food, and so was the kid. Is that gone by the board?
I would say, based on all the dietary surveys that are out there, that's across the board, not just babies. You know, I think if we're all honest with each other, we all will default to what's most convenient. And these products just didn't exist. I agree. Not just in the day you're talking about with your children. Like, I think even like when I was a child, they certainly weren't around. We saw a 900% increase just in 13 years. They were almost non-existent 13 years ago. And now they completely dominate the market, these squeeze pouches I'm referring to. But in general, we know that the consumption of ultra-processed foods and beverages is extremely high here in the U.S. In fact, those products represent more than half of all calories consumed by the population. And so we have all defaulted to a convenient type of diet. And sadly, the convenient type of diet is certainly not the healthiest type of diet with these heavily packaged. I mean, the U.S. packaged food supply is the largest in the world. At any one point in time, there are 400,000 plus food and beverage products on grocery store shelves, much larger than any other country.
Wow. It's kind of scary. So let's go back to the claims, the faulty claims that you mentioned. I don't know what the percentage of them, but a lot of foods have faulty claims that essentially they're fooling the parents by presenting a health halo, correct? Is that how you phrased it?
That's right.
So
we call it a health halo because, you know, the average person, and unless they really have the time to sit there and scrutinize the labels there, they're really being driven by what is on the front of the package that they're looking at. And if it says no added sugar, no added salt, or it might say organic or non-GM, no pesticides, what the really common ones are no added colors or flavors, you know, no preservative free. You know, they'll think that this product is a healthier choice, but who's to say that the product next door to it that doesn't have those claims is healthier or not? The only way to know, and I tell this to any mother who asks me advice, I say, do not look at the front of the pack. Flip them over and have a look at the back. Have a look at the ingredients list. Have a look at the nutrition label. Ignore the noise on the front and use the information on the back. And if you don't know what an ingredient is, you probably shouldn't be buying that product.
So the big lie is always what comes up front on the
yes, absolutely. Yes.
So
and personally, what I would love to see, just a very simple thing in the baby food sector in the U.S. is just to limit the number of claims and the types of claims they're allowed to make. Because in reality, if you could just do that, you'll help some people. But for now, that's not going to happen. We all know how powerful big business is here in the U.S., especially the food industry.
Yeah.
And so it's really up to these time poor parents to try and make the best choice. And so I always say, pick it up and turn it over. And remember that 5 grams of sugar is 1 teaspoon. So if your pouch has 20 grams of sugar, that's 4 teaspoons of sugar you're feeding your kid. So remember that. And think about that.
Well, okay. That's a good thing to think about. Now, I'm wondering if I will give you the authority to limit the list of claims. What would you put on? What claims would you allow, Dr. Elizabeth?
So I would allow the same claims that WHO does. The WHO does allow claims related to dietary practices. So if it's kosher, for example, it does allow you to have vegan or vegetarian claims on pack.
Okay.
I would even be okay with claims such as no pesticides or sort of the environmental type claims. Personally, I'm more okay with those. The no BPA and the non-GM, although, again, this isn't necessarily related to the nutritional component. It is related to overall health. The ones I would really like to see removed are the no added sugar and the no added salt, because no added sugar does not mean low sugar. And I think that one in particular is probably what gets a lot of people confused.
I guess you could put a pouch full of sugar water and sell it as something and then just say no added sugar because you didn't put any more sugar in it or something like that. Now, I understand. So you can do pure fruit juice puree and then write no added sugar on the label.
That's right.
But when in fact the whole thing is sugar anyway. So
that's right. And they can have I think there was one I saw with 17 grams of sugar. And that's a lot. There's not even that much in a piece of fruit, you know. You've got more sugar from fruit in the fruit pouch than you do from a piece of fruit. But the piece of fruit is bigger and obviously got other elements in there, you know. And we know this when you juice something, when you condense it down, of course, you're losing a lot of the part of the product that makes it healthy. But, you know, a lot of parents just see the no added sugar and assume, well, it's fruit, it's healthy. But in reality, if you're sucking down 3 fruit pouches in a row. That is a mighty amount of sugar for a young body, and it's certainly not as much as they would eat if the actual fruit was put in front of them.
So what happens when a young body is fed that much sugar?
That's the million-dollar question, and it depends if you mean instantly or over time. But we know for sure that in the U.S. that 50% of sugar from in these young kids' diet is coming from squeeze pouches. So that's a lot. We know is coming from just these one type of product. But sugar in itself has many issues. The squeeze pouches are linked to dental issues. Right? So you're sucking down that much sugar. It's just like if you're drinking sugary drinks. It's all going through past the teeth. More potential for dental problems, obviously linked to obesity, overweight as they age. And because these dietary behaviors really do shape things like body weight and eating behaviors later in life, you're just setting yourself up for failure in many cases. And look, again, I'm not judging, because I myself gave my kids these squeeze pouches. It's just what I hope parents can understand is these are not supposed to be a dominant part of the diet. These are supposed to be something to help when you're on the run, perhaps. Say, for example, you have to head to the store and it's a kid's lunchtime and you just don't have the time. Sure, using these products to supplement or to use when you need to, that's okay, but they should not be where they are getting the majority of their nutrition for, especially when we found that a lot of them, and the squeeze pouches, they're not very high in protein. And protein and iron in particular are extremely important for this first 1,000 days of life.
Out in nature, mothers teach their babies what and how to eat. And that's where baby critters learn how to eat for the rest of their life and what not to eat, which plant is good, which plant is bad, and so on. So as our mothers in the city have very, very little time, are they not very much in danger of teaching their children how to eat the wrong foods by using these baby pouches?
I mean, possibly the part of the issue is that these pouches really are new. Like we said, there's this 900% increase in 13 years. And so seeing these long-term effects, it's going to take time. But in terms of whether children model their parents' behavior, well, of course, I mean, we can just say that we all know that that would be true. And the less healthy the parents, the less healthy the child is likely to be. But like I said, I mean, as parents, we're also eating a lot of processed foods ourselves, right? A lot of convenient foods. If a parent is choosing these squeeze pouches for their kids, they're probably already time poor for themselves. And so I doubt they're also cooking everything for scratch from themselves. So, yeah, we could talk about it all day, I guess, in terms of like what would lead to what. But sure. we certainly as a nation are getting less healthy and eating more processed foods. And another research area, this is a slight tangent, I apologize, but it's related in that what I'm researching now using these data are looking at the use of additives in these products. And my research previously has looked at the use of additives and how many products with additives Americans are buying. And, you know, it's exploded over just over a 20-year period. It's exploded. And baby foods is actually the category which has had the highest increase in terms of products with additives and products with more than 3 additives as well. And again, can go down a whole path here on what the terrible additives that are allowed to be used here in this country, which are not allowed in any other country in the world. But specifically for baby foods, I did a quick scan of the data set before this podcast came about, and I saw that 11% had phosphate additives. So this is a specific type of additive. They're terrible. There's no need for them to be there. And I compared it to my Australian data set, which only had 3%. And so the American food supply here is just saturated with additives, with these squeeze pouches high in sugar. Well, and we're not really giving consumers a good chance.
We have just a minute left, but neurodevelopmentally, babies need to experience food. They need to get it on their hands and in their face. True?
Yes, absolutely.
Why?
That helps you understand how food is supposed to feel in your mouth. So if you think of, again, like a piece of fruit versus a fruit pouch, when you're eating a piece of fruit, even if it's cut up, you're understanding the feel of it. You're learning how to chew. So with these squeeze pouches, it also takes away that need to chew food, to actually process it. It's the same argument you would use for eating fruit versus drinking a fruit juice, and that you are sort of missing out on a lot of the other parts of that food as well. So an apple, for example, you're going to lose a bit of that fiber and how that food is put together, and the mouthfeel, how you're supposed to chew it. All of these things work together, and you know, otherwise we'd all just be on a liquid diet, I assume, if it wasn't important to
sit there and chomp
down on the food.
I just figured it out. They're training us all to be astronauts.
There you go.
There we go.
They're going to shoot us into space. Yeah.
So when we come back, we're very fortunate to have a mother on the line, so we're going to get some lessons on how to wean and feed the baby from a real mother. And she's a nutritionist, Dr. Elizabeth Dunsford. Do stay tuned. We will be right back after these messages.
So much to say, so little time to say it. On the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back. Yes, this is the Food Chain. Today we're talking about the time it takes to feed baby. We city people have a lot on our hands, and very little of that what we have on our hands is time. We are time short people because we live in the city and it's expensive to live here, and you have to keep on the go to make it in the city. And most of us live in the cities. So, how do we come to grips with baby who needs food all day long? And not only that, needs good food, needs a lot of food with a lot of protein and good fats, probably the hardest thing to find. So here today, we're fortunate enough to have a real live mother, Dr. Elizabeth Dunsford, who not only is a mother, but she is a research fellow with George Institute and an assistant professor of nutrition at the University of North Carolina. So, yes, one busy mom. How did you fare as a time poor parent? You gave us a brief description earlier, but how did you do that?
So I will say, you know, I wasn't perfect. I may be a nutritionist. I may be a researcher in a specific area. I may know more than the average person about what to do in the grocery store. But even then, no, I definitely defaulted many times to these convenient products. My kids certainly do not eat perfectly, but I really did just try my best to identify products where possible that I could give my kids that weren't the worst. Let me put it that way. And again, I feel a bit luckier in that I did maybe know a bit more about what to do, but it doesn't mean that I always did it perfectly, and I wouldn't expect any mother to do it perfectly. As mothers, time-poor mothers, we do our very best, and I think that's all we can do for our kids. And hopefully publishing research like this really just helps keep that awareness out there that we do have to really just be careful when we're choosing these types of products for our children.
Okay, take us to the grocery store. Where do we start? Baby's hungry. We want to buy something that we can prepare and maybe have some stashed away so that in emergencies. So where do we start, Dr. Elizabeth?
This is a very interesting question, and I will say it's going to be nuanced because it'll depend, first and foremost, is the child with you when you're in the grocery store? Because that in and of itself, we know, can drive people to choose certain things because you may have a tantrum on your hands if you choose the wrong thing. Now, if the child is not with you and you have that wonderful luxury that all mothers of young children just love, grocery store by yourself, it's a wonderful thing. If they have that, then this another important question is, what is the age of the child we're talking about? Because there is a big difference between a 4-month to 6-month old where you're starting to try and introduce some foods to perhaps a child close to the end of that 1,000 days, maybe closer towards
Let's talk about a baby that's still eating baby's food and is just weaning off the breast or the bottle.
The 6 to 12 month range is where, the 6 to 12 month range is where you're trying to, these products are called complementary foods, right? They're supposed to be complementary to breastfeeding or formula. And really just trying to help introduce your child to different flavors, different textures. Because even within purees, we know there are different sort of levels of pureeing and textures. And those products that I recommend you start with are the very plain single ingredient products. That is what is recommended for the first sort of introduction for kids. Things like sweet potato, pureed sweet potato, or pureed green beans, pureed apple and pear, sort of the simpler flavors, trying to get your child used to those. And then as the months go by, I think the baby food companies have really tried to help guide consumers. They call them stage one and stage two. If you head into stage two, which will be sort of your more sort of 7 to 10 months range, then you start doing some mixed products, you know, some of these purees that might have a mixture. Now, personally, I would be recommending you try and use tubs and jars, because then you are ensuring that you are spoon feeding your baby, and your baby might even be using a spoon themselves by that time, really helping them learn how to eat. But pouches are really, that's when pouches start to be used a lot. And so if you are going to go down the convenient line of pouches, you know, again, my suggestion is just making sure you're aware of what's in the product that you're buying and that you're only using it as something occasional or maybe once a day and not for every single meal, not for every single type of food. Now, that's just the baby food section. Obviously, you need to be feeding your child other things as well. And if you have the time, like you said earlier yourself, throw things in a blender, blend it up at home, blend what you're eating, blend the food from scratch. If you have that ability, a lot of my friends who have young children right now, they freeze the purees that they mix with the smoothie. That's an option as well. And you can obviously do food prep in that sense. You can make it yourself and store it for later, which is a great idea. You can also, another recommendation I give to people, I did it myself. I didn't like the yogurt products that were in pouches that were out there, but I did use those. I did want pouches for convenience, so I bought the pouches that are empty, and I created those yogurt mixes myself so that there was no added sugar in those yogurts. I would buy natural yogurt and mix it with some pureed fruit and give that to my children. And so you can definitely make those small changes that will get you a little bit healthier than the commercially produced foods, but that can also offer a level of convenience. But yeah, but again, I could go around the grocery store. You can go to the dairy aisle. Obviously, there's a lot of baby food products in the dairy aisle. Again, my recommendation is you've got to look at those ingredients. I can give a perfect example. I have a yogurt product that I buy for my children, but it was quite expensive one day, and I looked to the cheaper option next to it, but I thought I'd better check the ingredients first. And sure enough, the cheaper one had some terrible additives that the more expensive one did not. And so you really do have to, at that point, make a choice. If cost is your most important factor, then, you know, you may be sacrificing a little health-wise, or if that's not, then you know, you could always choose the one that is a little bit better. But you do have to look at that ingredients list, and anything that you don't know is probably not good for your baby.
You brought up an interesting word, complementary foods. And I think, yes, you know, I think that would be a wise thing for everybody to think about, even parents without children, because we all tend to make convenience foods or complementary foods real foods or mm-hmm. regular foods, when we should only be thinking of it in terms of emergency foods or need-help foods or something like that. We'd probably all do much better in that respect. You mentioned prep. You mentioned that you took time out of your day to to prepare foods that you could freeze or have in standby. So how did you do that? Where did you find the time to do that as a researcher, as a scientist, as a professor, as a mother? Where'd you get the time?
So I will be completely honest with you. I'm one of the lucky people that had the time. I was not working full time when my children were that age. And I think that goes back perhaps a little bit to the culture I was brought up with, that can link to a different discussion here. But in Australia, we get a year's maternity leave when we have a child. So the first year you are not working, and you are able to dedicate some of this extra time to perhaps make some healthier choices, because you are not quite as time poor. And so for me, I was time poor in my own mind, but I was certainly not as time poor as some of those parents who are back at work only, say, a month after giving birth to their child and they are back at work full time. I certainly was not as time poor as they are or were. And so I was lucky enough to have a little bit of extra time.
Extra time.
That is the only way. Personally, if I had to go back to work at 4 months postpartum, I do not know how unhealthy my children would have been, but they would have been much less healthy than they were, that's for sure. I completely identify with parents out there who are just doing the best they can.
So in that respect, you know, allowing for maternity leave is probably a good investment for society at large. Because
absolutely, it was one of the most shocking things. Yep, shocking things that I found when I moved over here. I could not believe that a woman is still not even recovered from childbirth and she's expected to be back at work while her child can't be breastfed because you can't have your child with you at work all day. And so really just you're already setting a precedent of bad health for future generations, in my opinion. I think maternity leave should be an absolute minimum 6 months.
And a good investment when it gets right down to it.
Absolutely, yes.
So you are now looking at additives to baby food, not just labeling and whatnot, but what companies are actually putting in baby food. Why? And you mentioned phosphate. Why? What are they seeking to gain? Is it a shelf life issue, which is usually why people add things to foods?
Right.
So
it's multifactorial. I'm interested in not just baby foods, although that is my is certainly my current little area interest. I am interested in the entire food supply because we are all consuming these processed packaged foods. I mean, 75% of all the foods we eat are packaged. That says it all. Mm-hmm. So these are very important. And again, as someone who moved from a country with quite a different food supply, same food supply but different ingredients, I was very surprised. Everything in the U.S. tastes sweeter. Everything is sweeter over here. The additives that are used in the U.S., there are many more additives that are allowed to be used here than are allowed in other countries. There are those classic additives like your red 40 or yellow 5, yellow 6, blue 1. They come up time and time again as being linked to behavioral issues, health-related issues in children. And you can, it's a fun fact, and it's not related to babies, but it is related to kids. If you take Kellogg's Fruit Loops as a very specific example, and you look at the same product, Kellogg's Fruit Loops are sold all over the world. If you take Australia, the United Kingdom, and the US, they all have different ingredients. And the only one of those three that has terrible additives in it is in the US. They have red 40, blue 1, yellow 5, yellow 6. And in the UK and Australia, for coloring, they do not use artificial colors. They use things like beet extract, curcumin, natural products. And guess what? Those products still taste yummy and kids still like them. And so I've really become quite passionate about looking at these additives that are being used in the U.S. And then phosphates in particular, I'm kind of surprised by, just because they're used. It's so ubiquitous here in the food supply in the U.S. And you're right, some of it will come down to shelf life, but not all of it. You can have the same product side by side. I put that yogurt example I gave you that for my children. Mm-hmm. The only difference was the addition of phosphates. And so if both products are essentially the same and one has them and one doesn't, we know that the product doesn't need them, really. They add them in because they're probably cheaper, They probably allow them to use less and more expensive ingredients. There are many reasons why companies would choose to use various food additives here in the U.S. So I hope that research into what's in the baby foods, and I haven't done it yet. I've started the research, but I really hope that whatever I find, we can put out there to the public so that parents can be more aware on a deeper level of what ingredients they should avoid.
Well, I'm really happy to hear that because that means I get to do another radio show with Dr. Elizabeth Dunsford and learn about feeding babies and feeding ourselves. Got a minute or so left, Dr. Dunsford. What do time-poor parents need to do to be a good parent in spite of being time-poor?
I just say try your best. It's not going to be perfect. Don't aim for perfection. Just aim to do the best you can. And again, I'll keep repeating the same thing, but ignore the noise on the front of all the packages of food you look at. Turn it over and have a look. Make sure the sugar's not crazy. And make sure you know the name of the ingredients that you're reading. And if you don't, choose another product.
What other product?
Really? A product which has ingredients that you recognize.
Yeah. So you're looking for real foods, right?
Yeah, and there are options, you know. Not every single product has terrible additives. Not every single product has crazy amounts of sugar. They will definitely be able to find a better choice. And I like to say even a small change can make a big change over time. Even if you're choosing one with just a couple of grams less of sugar, if you do that on a daily basis, over time you're getting less. And that a small change is still a big change over time.
And I would like to add, though I'm certainly not an expert in childhood nutrition, teach the kid how to get the food into their hands and into their face. You might have to use a washcloth to wipe off their face and their hands. But my goodness, you're teaching the kid how to eat and how to love eating. And if you have
and make it fun. Yeah, make it fun.
Make it fun. Yeah. All right. Well, this has been a lot of fun, talking babies food with Dr. Elizabeth Dunsford. Well, and thank you on behalf of everybody for doing this study, because by holding up what is not in the baby's food, I think you're going to raise the consciousness of all of us. And we'll all make better parents, even those of us who don't have children in the house. We'll all become more cognizant of what it takes to raise good children. And that way we'll be allowing of things like childhood, maternity leave, and so on. Dr. Elizabeth, thank you so much. And hey out there, remember Michael Olson's third law of the food chain, cheap food isn't.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.